So we will get started because some of us have weird time commitments, and if somebody rushes out, it's just because you're in violent disagreement with what Janet is saying, I'm sure. Most of you don't know Janet, so I will give about a two-hour introduction to leave her 5 minutes to talk on her topic. But before doing that, this re-inspires confidence in me that we are, in fact, a liberal arts institution, that there are faculty, students, and community members who are willing to engage during a lunch hour, whatever you want to call this period, in some serious thinking about possibly our new trend for the way the life, the truth is through science. But very briefly, those who don't know, Janet teaches philosophy here. Some of her expertise, some of you who work the food theme have heard her as an expert in feminist epistemology. So if you want to know about skinny bitches, Janet will inform you about what this does to your image of the world and to yourself. But some of you, and of course philosophy of science is the other area that Janet has worked a lot on and teaches. She also has been a volunteer in tons of groups, so the Citizens for Public Justice, for example, then for Kairos, which is an ecumenical organization. You were on the Ecological Justice, I think, committee, and maybe still are. So here's a public intellectual who actually engages the world and at the same time reflects profoundly and philosophically about significant matters. So welcome, Janet.
Thank you. So I'm going to treasure that, Dietmar. That was very kind of you to call me a public intellectual. Depends on what you think of the size of Camrose, I suppose. One of the first things I have to say was, and Dietmar brought it up, I think he raised expectations by talking about my skinny bitch presentation. And I said to my colleague, Roxanne, before I came here, I said, 90% of people are going to come because they want to look at these salacious pictures that I showed the last time. There are no pictures, and you're going to find out that...
Yeah, I have your memory stick. I think there's lots of
that presentation's on it, that's true. But no, there's no pictures of skinny scientists or bitchy scientists or any of those things. You're going to find out, too, that I don't really know very much about PowerPoint. The last time, it was a lovely student who put a nice background on it for me. So I will say, however, in case you're thinking, oh, darn, I wish I had come to something like this, is unlike most professional philosophers, I'm not going to present a paper either. What I have is, I flatter myself, it's fairly short. I have some remarks about my impression of this kind of conversation about religion and science, more importantly, science and myths. And then I would like for us to have a long discussion period or question periods about it. I want to start, well, first thing I'll say is the two intellectuals that I'm relying on or that I'm going to be drawing from in terms of describing this conversation are, first of all, Mary Midgley, who is a British philosopher. And this actually shouldn't matter, but I think I might as well be upfront about people's religious commitments. She is not a Christian. She's not a theist at all. And it's from her that I've shamelessly cribbed this title, because she's a book called Science as Salvation, A Modern Myth and Its Meanings. All right. The other person that I will be drawing on is Ian Barber, who is retired now. He might even be dead. I don't know.
Version of retirement.
That's a version of retirement. That's right. He's still retired in that case. He was a professor of professor of physics. And then not even the latter half of his career, but the last quarter of his career, for whatever reason, he got out of doing research in physics, and he became a professor of, of science and religion, something along those lines, in, a prestigious liberal arts college in the eastern part of the United States, whose name escapes me right now. The reason I've chosen both of these is there's a kind of, and he is a Christian, all right, so we have a non-Christian, a non-theist and a theist. And part of the reason I've chosen these two is, in my field at least, they're both extremely eminent, but more importantly, the two two books on which I'm going to draw from them are both versions of the Gifford Lectures that they gave in the early 90s. And let me just say about the Gifford Lectures, which takes place in Edinburgh, somewhere in Scotland, is that that's an extremely eminent kind of lecture to give. In other words, if I was ever invited to give the Gifford Lectures, trust me, you would all hear about it ad nauseum. Right? So these are really important. We're dealing with two gorillas of the intellectual world. All right, I want to start with a quote from Mary Midgley that's fairly long, and I didn't put it on PowerPoint. She begins her book by saying this. She actually began her Gifford Lectures by saying this. She says, "The idea that we can reach salvation through science is ancient and powerful. It is by no means nonsense, but it lies at present in a great deal of confusion. Its many strands, some helpful, some not, greatly need sorting. In the 17th century, where modern science first arose, it was an entirely natural thought." I want you to pay attention to this. She says, "The great thinkers of that time, of the 17th century, took it for granted as central to their endeavor. Nature was God's creation. And to study nature was simply one of the many ways to celebrate the glory of God. That celebration was understood to be the proper destiny of the soul, the meaning of human life. Since that time, things have changed greatly. For a number of reasons, God has been pushed to the background. The conceptual maps that God once dominated go on, however, being used as if they did not need much revision. This makes trouble on many issues and notions about the special saving power of science or among them." So that's the part I want to emphasize for the moment. That the conceptual maps that God once dominated go on being used as if they don't need much revision. And that makes trouble, particularly about the notion about the special saving power of science. So science as salvation, as something that can save us. Okay? All right, I want you to notice a couple of other things, and you might get impatient because I'm going to come up with all these caveats, but that's partly what philosophers do. I'm not particularly interested in religion or in what religion is. Or maybe I should put it this way. I don't think the issue here is religion. The issue, so what is the issue, right? The issue is seeing science as an antidote to religion or as a competitor to religion, or as a successor to religion. So it's not religion itself, it's seeing science in a certain kind of way, perhaps even in a religious way. Now, why do I find this tact particularly interesting? And once again, in the service of situating myself so you know who's talking to you, I'll explain how I came to this. Because I started out by looking at knowledge. As Dittmar said, I'm an epistemologist. I do philosophy of knowledge. And when you do philosophy of knowledge, especially in North America or in the United Kingdom, you're inexorably led to science. Why? Because science is generally taken as a paradigm for knowledge. So you're looking at knowledge, you're going to look at the best example of knowledge possible. And as a science being a paradigm for knowledge means that science is an ideal. It's a pattern for knowledge. So, by the way, this is a bit of a side that maybe I'll come back to later if we have time, is that part of the reason science has this huge status in our society is because of its success as a pathway to knowledge. Right? It's been very successful as a reliable pathway to knowledge, and so it functions as a paradigm for us. Then, you know, let's put that aside. We might get back to the success of science and how to explain that. Right? But, okay, I'm a philosopher by education and by training and, you know, unfortunately perhaps, but by temperament also. Right? So when I say I'm also a philosopher by training, it means that, and people often don't understand this, and this is true not just for philosophers, this is generally applicable to all of you, and particularly to those of you who are students, that when you're educated in a certain discipline, you're not just educated, you are apprenticed. You are taught to think a certain kind of way. And that's what I mean when I say I'm a philosopher by training as well. I'm taught to look for kinds of things. And, you know, I'm making a split-second decision if I should put any of my students on the spot here and ask them, what is it that philosophers look for? Well, I don't want to put anybody on the spot. Does anybody want to suggest, though? Volunteer? Good for you, Chloe. What?
Wisdom. Sorry, I'm not laughing because that was a silly answer.
That's the last time feel about it.
I know. Bad teacher, bad pedagogical moment. No, you're quite right, Chloe, actually, right? That's what philosophy means. It means love of wisdom. Although, of course, it doesn't matter what academic discipline you're in, we're all, in a sense, looking for wisdom or knowledge. But for philosophy, what kind of knowledge are they looking for? They're looking for the fundamentals, the principles. They're also looking for, and this is thought to constitute wisdom, and the rest of you aren't philosophers, needn't agree, because there's something arrogant about this, and I would be critical of it as well, but we're looking for deep patterns. Okay? All right, so this is my training. And when I start, and it's not that I'm the only one to have noticed this amongst philosophers, when I start, so I was led to look at science more closely, because it's a paradigm for knowledge. Knowledge is what I was originally interested in. When I started looking at the claims made by science, and more importantly, I think, the claims made on behalf of science, my skeptical faculties were poked in a very uncomfortable way, sort of like you might know the very famous quote from Hume, where from Kant, when he said he was woken from his dogmatic slumber by Hume. And I suppose in some ways I was woken from my slumber that, you know, science was one social institution like some other social institutions when I started noticing the claims made on behalf of science. What sort of claims? Well, I'm going to give you one from, maybe I will as well. Let me give you one from Dawkins. Okay, Richard Dawkins is a biologist, although I'm wondering if there's anybody here that I'm going to inadvertently insult. But Dawkins, who, by the way, I need to point out, has not actually practiced science since 1975 or whatever it is. He's, I'll say something about that later on, perhaps. Okay, here's a quote from him. I want you to notice the emotion here. He joyfully proclaims, he says this. This, by the way, is in the Selfish Gene, so it's from sometime in the 70s. He says, since we now have modern biology, we no longer have to resort to superstition when faced with the deep problems. What deep problems? Like, is there a meaning to life? What are we for? What is man? You know, I must have missed that class in Bio 101. Because I never got those answers from it. All right? Here's another one from, I want to choose people who are, fairly current. Oh, yeah, this is a great one from Stephen Hawking, who I actually quite like reading, because he's a very, very good writer. He says that, you know what, we're getting a cosmological theory, and it doesn't mean cosmological in the philosophical sense, he means in physics. And he says, when that finally has emerged, when we've completed it, which, by the way, is going to be very, very shortly, right, it's coming soon, we shall all, philosophers, it's so nice that he includes us, hey? But philosophers, scientists, and just the rest of you ordinary people, we shall all be able to take part in the discussion of the question why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, as we surely shall, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God. Once again, I didn't get that in my physics classes. On what basis is he saying those things? And anyways, what does he mean by God? That's very important. And then one that's not nearly so so controversial, I suppose. Peter Atkins, another physicist. And he says, with the same tone of voice as Richard Dawkins, he's rejoicing, he says, literally, he says this because he says physics has progressed to the point where the creator has absolutely no job to do and can be allowed to evaporate and disappear from the scene. Now, what's interesting about these things is that these people are making claims that they consider to be scientific. Because they're scientific claims. They think they have scientific warrant, or warrant from physics, or warrant from biology, from saying those things. That reminds me as well, I don't think any of my chemistry colleagues are here, but there's something unusual about chemistry, because you rarely find chemists making these kinds of statements. Only biologists, only physicists.
I don't know why that is, but I have a hypothesis that I'd be happy to share with you if you bring it up.
There's lots of stuff at the end.
That's right, we're waiting for the end. Okay. See, so I may not be particularly competent. In fact, I'm probably not competent at all in judging one scientific explanation against another scientific explanation. But I can recognize a metaphysic when I see one, because that's my field, and that's what I've been trained to do. And interestingly enough, that's part of what that's why I had that little side path talking about being trained to see a metaphysics. Any of us can be trained to see a metaphysic. That's in part what philosophy is about. However, interestingly as well, you can also be trained not to see metaphysics, or you can be trained to ignore metaphysics when you see them, or to be completely blind to them. I'll come back to that. So we better get to some definitions now. And Herr Mundell, my lovely assistant. Yeah? There it is. I was a little bit worried about putting this kind of, you know, coming up with a definition in Descartes, because it's always dangerous to come up with a definition of something that is complex. And also because, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but I really don't care what definition you come up with for science, for religion, because it's not the focus of my talk. But okay, what I will also say before we go on with these other definitions is, I'll be upfront about it, to a certain extent, I've stipulated these definitions in the interest of allowing our conversation to go on. But I want to let you know that we can discuss any of these definitions that I'm giving you afterwards, or even, I suppose, during. And the other thing is, I will assure you that none of the definitions I've given you are idiosyncratic. Right? They're not just like my weird little way of looking at these things. So, like I said, let's start with religion. And I've tried for the broadest possible form of religion to encompass as much of what is generally identified and self-identified as religion as possible, so that, you know, I want a big tent here is what I'm saying. And here's Ian Barber, the physicist. Here's his definition of religion that he gave during the Gifford lectures. He said that religion is a way of life that often, but not always, includes a set of intellectual beliefs and abstract ideas. More centrally, religion aims at the transformation of personal life. How to transform personal life? Well, particularly by liberation from self-centeredness through commitment to a more inclusive center of devotion. And then I added being here, because I knew that some people, and fair enough, would quibble and say, well, that's not a theistic definition of religion unless you put the deity part in there. To be fair to Barber, by the way, the reason he didn't do that was because he wanted to include all religion. He wanted to include non-theistic religions, like, what's a non-theistic religion? Yeah, Buddhism. Right. He didn't want it to just be a religion that was for particularly Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Okay. Now, notice that while in this definition we're not excluding beliefs, intellectual beliefs, and ideas, I certainly haven't, in what I just read to you, emphasized them, because what I really want to emphasize is that it's a way of life, that religion's a practice, it's a way of life. Right? In other words, you've all heard that practice what you preach. Well, we all know that people preach, some of them are religious as well, but they don't always practice. No, let's really look at the practice to see what they really believe, as opposed to what they say they believe. All right. And I also want to point out, you may not be comfortable with this understanding of religion, but if you look at religion worldwide, and certainly religion throughout history, so historically, probably the vast majority of adherents can neither express what they believe in terms of abstract ideas, nor can they explain what they believe in terms of ideas. Rather, they have a set of practices, a way of life. All right. Okay, now, what is this thing called science? Excellent. Okay. This one, I'm not as worried about. I mean, you might disagree with it, particularly if you're a scientist, but this is really not idiosyncratic. This is the way most, if you know the literature, most science theorists and most philosophers understand science. They say that science is, it really consists of a bunch of descriptions. These are descriptions of the natural world. But there are certain kinds of descriptions. They're not descriptions that are necessarily concerned with beauty, the beauty of nature, or our relationship to nature, any of those kinds of things. They are descriptions of the natural world that help us predict the natural world. And because we can predict it, eventually we can also sometimes control it. A very common definition of science. Sometimes the control part, by the way, that's why I put it in brackets, although most people don't put it in brackets. Sometimes the control part comes a lot later. That we have that we have a description of the natural world, then eventually we come up with some predictions. Well, if this is the way things really work, then this is my hypothesis. You set up a bunch of experiments to test it. Oh, hey, presto, it worked. That's good. Maybe I can get tenure now. And then eventually, sometimes immediately, but sometimes way down the road, you have an application of those theories to the natural world. And this business, too, about control, you shouldn't necessarily think that this is anything sinister or nefarious. Right? I say to my students, and I know I'm being flippant when I say it, but I do mean it. I'm a fan of, like, indoor plumbing, right? And electric lights and polio vaccines and so on and so forth. I'm glad science controls the natural world that way. It makes my life a whole lot more comfortable. So science, what you should notice here too, is premised on, or, you know, it's interested in this relationship of cause and effect. That's what that definition basically says. It's interested in finding or figuring out how things happen. That's why, in part, science works the way it works. So another way to put these two phenomenon, do you want to try the next slide? I don't know. Yeah. Another way to understand this phenomenon, this is more the way Barber explains it, but religion tries to answer why questions. Right? Why is the world like this? Why are we like this? Why do we exist? Those kinds of things. Why do we have a purpose in life? And science tries to answer or asks how questions. How does that work? Give us a because why questions are typically answered with a prescription. This is what you ought to do. Or this is how it ought to be. And how questions are typically answered with a descriptive answer. This is the way things work. Well, first A, and then B, sometimes we have it, and then so on and so forth. That's how those questions work. Back to philosophy, just very briefly for a moment. Philosophy also asks why questions. I think that's what Chloe was getting at when she very bravely volunteered an answer to what philosophy looks for. It looks for wisdom. It's looking for why questions, but not because it's aiming at personal transformation. Rather, because what I'm doing is aiming at understanding knowledge or knowing knowledge. And just as a little aside here, you might notice that philosophy is sort of straddling science and religion, or in a sense it's trying to take something from both of them. And that's probably not very important, but my little aside is that it makes for some really interesting moments in teaching students when they expect, for example, for me to, or not for me, but they expect in a philosophy class or they expect at university to figure out what the meaning of life is, but they're going to the wrong place. You know, you don't go to philosophy for that. Or they expect sometimes as well to be answers to how questions. And the same thing, I say this regularly to my class, and they laugh at me because they don't think I'm serious. But I'm quite serious. I'm not interested, philosophers typically, we're not interested in empirical things or, you know, what really happens. Okay. All right, so this is where metaphysics and myth both come in. So, because Phil's the only other philosopher here, what I like about this, I get to say whatever I like, because he's, you know, he's the only one who would probably disagree with me and won't. It's very collegial about the stand-up. Pardon? Were you going to say something? That's okay. We can talk about it. Okay, metaphysics. There's other definitions, all right, but just as a general rule, because this isn't a talk on philosophy, but metaphysics is the study of the underlying nature of reality, including the conditions for reality existing. All right? So that's what I mean, too, when I said, well, it looks at fundamental questions, like very deep questions. All right? What conditions are necessary for the world to exist as we know it? Or not as we know it, but as it does exist, in fact. Okay. All right. So now, what's a myth? It's actually quite closely related. But anyways, I'm going to use I'm going to use Mary Midgley's definition of a myth, also from the Gifford Lectures, 1992. Myth, she says, is a guiding system of thought. When she says guiding here, she means something that is a very deep system of thought, because it's something that we have a really hard time. It's guiding, so it's one of those ones that it's like a meta system of thought, if you want to put it that way. And so it's very destabilizing intellectually and emotionally when we start fiddling around with our myths. Not that we can't do it, by the way. So it's a guiding system of thought that colors our imagination. So it's very... Oh, I didn't put that part in, but okay, she did. It's a guiding system of thought that colors our imaginations. It brings imagination to life in some ways, if you can put it that way. It animates imagination. And it's also a pattern of thought that we follow at a very deep level in trying to meet our imaginative needs. So, in a sense, metaphysics is a more overt and systematic understanding of what our myths really are. Right? Let's put it this way. Everybody has myths. I would also say that everybody has a metaphysics, but a lot of people aren't aware of what their metaphysics are, because what you have to do with the metaphysic is draw it out, systematize it. Oh, so for example, one of the things you're assuming is that humans are essentially greedy, and that's why capitalism is the best economic system, and so on and so forth. Okay. The other thing is, I didn't prepare very much in the way of remarks on this part. Actually I did, but I'll just flag it. This is about our imaginative needs. Imaginative needs are, according to Midgley, probably some of the most important needs that human beings have. Because imagination is integral, it's one of the conditions necessary for any kind of thought. That imagination grounds thought, literal thought. Okay. So like I said, or I didn't say this, Midgley argues that myth-making is a vital human function. And for many people, nowadays, and up until relatively recently, for virtually all people, how did we make myths? Well, religion was the vehicle for myth-making. And just because religion is not that important anymore, maybe I should put it this way, just because we live in an officially secular society doesn't mean that myth-making's gone away. If Midgley's right, because myth-making is something that's vital to human functioning, human living, life. So what I'm interested in, this is why I said I'm not so much interested in religion, what I'm interested in is how myth-making seems to be a vital epistemic function. In other words, knowledge also, the construction of knowledge requires myth-making as a vehicle, if you want to put it that way. In other words, we all think by using myths. Even when we say things like, oh, that's not really what I mean, I didn't literally mean that, it's a metaphor. It's just a metaphor. Well, there is no such thing, if Midgley's right, and she's not the only one who's done work on this, but, you know, in the interest of time, there's no such thing as just a metaphor, especially if we can't think without metaphors. Then you can't say something like, oh, that's just a metaphor. For some, not just philosophers, theorists, people look at this, but for some of us, literal is, now I'm going to be smarty pants here, I'm going to mimic what I just said about just a metaphor. Well, literal is just the term that we apply to words that we are so familiar with and that we agree on so much that we no longer notice their metaphorical aspect. So what that means is when we decide that a word or an image has moved from being metaphorical to literal, it's fairly arbitrary. Depends on when we decide enough of us agree. Well, you say, well, how many of us need to agree? 30? 30,000? You know, it's kind of arbitrary. Right? And I can give you more examples of that, particularly, it's harder for me. I can give you examples of it from chemistry. And in fact, I had dinner twice now recently with a couple of chemists, and I pointed out how particularly metaphorical chemistry is, how much metaphor it uses in its language, and they found that completely uninteresting. And they said, well, they're just metaphors. But I think, in fact, it's not uninteresting. And I think, like I said, I don't think there's anything as just a metaphor. I also think, in part, it explains this difference between physics and biology and things they're willing to say and the fact that chemistry just can't be bothered with saying any of those things. Okay? All right. So, Midgley's point is, this is really my point in some ways, I guess, if we are not aware of our propensity to make myths, even in the most literal areas of life, like science, then we wind up making myths that deny that they're myths. We wind up making myths that we deny then are actually myths. The other thing I want to note before I go back to that particular point, because Midgley notes this, and I think this is an important aspect, that contemporary science is increasingly specialized and technical. And the specialization of science means that, this is not a criticism as far as I'm concerned, but the specialization of science means that it doesn't give us much by way of a general understanding of reality. And I think most of us, especially if we're not scientists, most of us actually, we don't understand science very well. And perhaps it's even the case that many scientists don't understand the science outside their fields very well, that they only have a very general idea of what goes on in somebody else's lab. Moreover, and this is quite important as well, the specialization of science contributes to the split of science from the rest of human life, not to mention the split of science from the humanities. So what that does is, those two factors combined with an overtly secular society leaves us, and I'll put this in quotation marks for the moment, leaves us vulnerable to the account given to us by, I'll just call them science popularizers, like Dawkins, Sagan, Atkins, Freeman, Dyson, all these kinds of people, who started out as scientists but aren't actually practicing science anymore, but are telling us why we should put our hopes in science, why we should see science as salvific. And we're left vulnerable to that. This is one moment. I can't resist this little bit of sarcasm, because people like Dawkins and Dyson, who I haven't talked about, but Carl Sagan, Peter Atkins, who I did talk about, Stephen Hawkins, they don't seem to have heard that a lot of other people in the humanities have given a lot of thought to what the meaning of human life might be, and what humans are here for, and what the world looks like. But in some ways, they can do that because of the split between the sciences and the humanities, particularly in the last probably 100 years. And why, now back to this one, I said vulnerable, and I put it in quotation marks. Why do I say vulnerable? Well, I'm not critical of people who wish to put their faith in science, who wish to use science as a guiding myth, as their particular myth. All right? I kind of have to take that back, because I am actually critical of that. But I'm not critical of it, or let's put it this way, I'm only critical of it because it's not a faith that I share. It's not a myth that I share. That's not my myth. All right? But that's not my point, because my point is that you're going to have a myth anyway, so I can't be critical of people for having a myth. What I'm critical of, I don't like that myth myself. Right? My point is that these popularizers, the people that I've been talking about, Dawkins and Dyson and so on and so forth, these popularizers set up science as opposed to religion. Right? And why would that be a problem? Because those popularizers who set up science as opposed to religion claim that religion has a metaphysics, and a naive and mistaken metaphysics at that. Right? Science, on the other hand, they claim doesn't have a metaphysic. Right? Science is simply, it's realistic. It's unmediated access to reality. Now, they also often say, Dawkins in particular, and there's a couple of other people, but they say that religion is dangerous in part because it's fundamentally misguided, because it's mistaken, because at best it's out of touch with reality. It's not realistic, right? It's out of touch with reality, and at worst, religion prevents us from getting in touch with reality. And when they're pushed on that, or when you try to tease out in their texts what they're saying, it's because they think religion is just a myth. Science, on the other hand, is not a myth. In other words, what they're doing is they're trying to set things up, or they frame the terms of the discussion such that it's not a level playing field anymore. Right? That you have these naive, superstitious religious types, and then you have them. And they're the hard-thinking, rational, objective science types. They don't have a myth. Right? science, they imply, you know, as compared or opposed to religion, science is simply a method for knowing how things really are. It alone gives us access to fundamental reality. And because it can, it's so fundamental, because it gets at reality in such a fundamental way that we can even answer questions that we thought we couldn't answer before, that we thought we had to go to myth to before. It can answer the why questions, like, why are we here? What is our purpose? Remember what Dawkins says? We can know the mind of God. And this is from a man who I don't think actually believes in a God in any usual sense of the word. Okay. So this is where me, the philosopher, and I hope actually most of you as well, but this is where I start to get kind of twitchy. Let's put it this way. I get twitchy, and not just because I'm territorial, and I think, hey, wait a minute, that's my intellectual territory, back off. Right? This is what philosophers do. You can't stray onto it. That's not the only reason. I start getting twitchy because they're telling me, literally, that this isn't a metaphysic. But it sure looks like a metaphysic to me. It looks exactly like the patterns that I've been trained to recognize. And not only that, it looks like a metaphysic, but it looks like a really strange metaphysic as well. One that's almost impossible to argue against, because it claims that it isn't a metaphysic. So every time you try to argue against it, they say, oh, no, this is just a literal truth. It's not, you know, it's not my position. This is what the facts tell me. And so it claims that it's not a metaphysic, but rather that, in fact, what it says is that science should and, in fact, does determine what our metaphysic is going to be. That first, we just, in a very neutral way, I'm just going to open my eyes and look around and find a bunch of facts, and I'm going to collect them together and figure out what they mean, and then, okay, and then I will construct this metaphysics for me, this ontology for myself. Okay? So, we're not really doing, when I say we, I mean in the 21st century in the West, we're not actually really doing anything differently than we've always done throughout human history in terms of myth-making and looking for explanations and so on and so forth, except now we seem to be curiously unwilling to be aware of what we're doing. Okay? So we're doing the same thing that our ancestors, I say our ancestors, like in my case, those of European descent, were doing 500 years ago, except now I want to tell myself that I'm not myth-making. I'm just getting the access to real reality or the truth. Okay, a couple other things. The one thing I want to say for a moment, because I haven't done this, I want to talk about real scientists. Most real, actually live scientists, nowadays at least, are really quite modest about what science can and cannot do. They're not like what I call the science popularizers. And they're also, by the way, people who are still actually engaged in doing science, so researching science and teaching science. Now why is that important? Well, first of all, so we should know that the picture presented to us by science popularizers probably isn't accurate. It's not empirically accurate. You know, so it's faulty. You know, it deserves to be criticized on two grounds. They claim that science is but an accurate view of the world, but they're not even portraying themselves. They're not even portraying science accurately, because I think that most scientists wouldn't necessarily recognize themselves in it. And I say that. I've known that for a long time, and poor Gerhard is going to say, oh gosh, I wish I'd never talked to her, because I'm going to repeat something that he said to me. But that is that Gerhard pointed out to me, you know, most of us scientists don't think that we're doing this, don't think that we're offering some kind of hope for life or the meaning of life, so on and so forth. So I want to take that into account. But I also want to point out where this, what was now a very characteristic modesty, where that originally came from, at least in the English-speaking world. That modesty was a response to some of the excesses of scientists who were indeed public intellectuals, not of which I'm not one, but they were public intellectuals in the earlier to mid-20th century. And there were two kinds of excesses, really. One, and I can give you the citations for this, you know, where I found this kind of stuff, but one of them was Freudian psychoanalysis,
which, by the way, and I have great respect for Freud, but you people, all, well, no, most of you probably know how hard it is to argue against psychoanalysis, because every time you say, or Freudian psychoanalysis anyways, because every time you say, well, I think blah, 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 it's always trying to, well, you think that you think that, but really it's because of, and so on and so forth. That's one. And more importantly, I think, the rise of the social sciences, all claiming to be scientific. And that was particularly in England, at least, in the around the 30s, probably, heavily influenced by British polymaths, so people who were, you know, incredibly well-educated and intelligent people. But these polymaths also happened to be Marxists. And we all know what happened to Marxism as a political theory after the Second World War. It became enormously unpopular. And these British Marxist polymaths, so I'm talking about people like Needham and Burnell and Haldane, all right, they were charismatic, they were very popular, they were very learned, you know, they were very well-educated writers who used their scientific credentials and their authority to back up their political views. Right? They used their scientific authority to give weight to their political views that Marxism was the way to go, for example. To be fair, a lot of other scientists, so I'm painting in broad brushstrokes now, but a lot of scientists in Britain at the time were, like most other people there, were fairly right-wing. They didn't see fascism as much of a threat. And they disagreed with these British Marxists, but they couldn't argue with the polymaths on their own terms, because they weren't as bright as they were, basically what it came down to. And so their way of dealing with it was to say that, well, science shouldn't deal with those questions. Science shouldn't deal with politics, for example. Right? That they were non-scientific issues. We have the next slide. And this is from Ian Barber. These are four relationships between religion and science. What I just talked about, saying, well, we shouldn't deal with those issues. They're political, they're non-scientific issues, is the independence thesis, the version that says that the relationship between science and religion is one of independence, right? There's science over here, and there's like politics or the humanities or whatever over there, and the two of them should never meet. And that grew out of things that happened, the very specific history, our very specific history in the early to mid-20th century. But that's part of what I want to end with. That is only one particular version of it. Right? In fact, there are four different ways that science and religion can interact. One is conflict, which is the first thing that I was talking about. And I'll just throw this as an aside. Barber, I'm not sure I completely agree with him, but it's quite interesting. It's controversial. Barber says that when the relationship between science and religion is one of conflict, it's because the versions there is a biblical literalism, that version of religion, and a scientific materialism, which is a naive sort of empiricism on the part of science. If, on the other hand, you want scientists who are characteristically modest and say, I don't know, I'm just doing my science and so on and so forth, that's a version of the independence thesis. What would be far more interesting is to see a version of science and religion or science and myth-making that had to do with dialogue, or even more strongly, that actually sought to be integrated in some respect. Okay. So the final thing that I want to say, because why shouldn't we just end with the independence thesis? Well, I don't think we should end there, because science does deal with, you know, this sounds trivial, I don't mean it in a trivial sort of way, it deals with very interesting topics, and they affect human life. The best example of that I can think of is the conception of order and causation that's so central to science is also an important background to our thought about all kinds of things, not just in the natural world, but in the humanities, for example. Not to mention, of course, something else that's enormously important, our relationship to other species, which is where Midgley started her career. So a bunch of facts has no value by itself. We need to have an interpretive
scheme for organizing and understanding those facts. That's why the relationship between, I put religion here because I'm quoting Barbara, but I really think between myth-making and science is so important. Because I don't think we can end the conversation by saying, look, the best interpretive scheme, the best myth we can have is a scientific method. And of course, that's not really a myth. That's just reality. I think I want to end here. Open it up for discussion.
So there's seven things that we're going to be mentioning at the end. Later we will talk about possibly. Anyhow, I've got a little checklist and to see whether some of you can pick them up. And I think, yeah, Jan will just field them.
Oh, good, good, good. Jonathan.
So here you talk about independence as being one of the possible relationships between religion and science. So I'd like to ask about the relationship between this and the previous slide, where you said science deals with questions of how, and religion deals, and so it's one more before that.
Okay, whatever, yeah.
Religion deals with questions of why.
Mm-hmm.
Are you putting this forward as one of your stipulated definitions, or is this one theory of the relationship between science and religion?
What,
because this would appear to be supporting the independence thing.
That's right, yeah.
And yet, what you're saying then is that the science popularizers think that the first statement is false, that science also wants to answer why.
And can.
And a certain group of religious people, including a large group within my own denomination, think the second one is also too restrictive. They also want to answer how questions. So,
yeah.
You know, when I say to them that I think this is a convenient dichotomy and I like to organize my brain around this, so I say, well, the creation myths are talking about why
mm-hmm.
God did this
mm-hmm.
and that, and they say, no, it also tells you how. So they regard me as being intellectually arrogant by saying that there should be this distinction. And of course, I regard the scientists and those religion people as being intellectually arrogant for thinking that they can answer all the questions.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, do I really mean what I put up on the slide in a sense? Yeah, but with... the way that I think probably you would as well, Jonathan, with some caveats, right? Which is that, at a certain level, you can keep them independent of each other. But on another level, when you really start to delve into some of these questions, I think that when we look at the how, it's going to give us clues to how we might answer the whys, the other direction is more difficult. That how we answer the why questions might tell us something about how to start going about the how questions. The example that you gave me, and if you don't want to go down this road, that's fine, then just stop me, about people wanting to say that the story of how the world was created answers a how question that was created in 7 24-hour days and so on and so forth, have probably, in that sense, it's one of those questions that I think we need to talk about. One of those examples I think we need to talk about, but it doesn't get at the potential integration between those two questions because it's not a deep enough question. But when people start to use, for example, the creation story as an answer to a how question, it loses its function as a why question.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so yeah, I don't have to go on. You see what I mean? In other words, so what is, and it's not just the Christian myth about how the world was created. I'm sorry, I'm using how, but I don't mean how in that sense, right? Most world religions have these myths about how the world came into existence, and I don't think that they were trying to teach us science when they did that. But they might have something to say to us about science.
I think they were trying to teach us science. I think they saw it as an all-encompassing answer, and we have posited this as a convenient dichotomy to allow ourselves to keep these things separate.
Uh-huh.
But they did not intend them to be separate. We are imposing
That I think is true, Jonathan. But here is where maybe I'm more than stipulating. Maybe this is where we disagree. I don't think, though. Let's put it this way: when those creation myths were written,
or even just told when they were created. There was no such thing as science.
Right.
Well, so it wasn't intended to be science, was it? It wasn't intended to teach us science.
It was intended to answer all questions.
That's right. It was intended to give us knowledge, to orient our, to orient us in a world, and in a physical world, and so on and so forth. But it seems a bit strange.
Isn't that science, though?
Sorry?
Orienting us in the physical world, isn't that science?
Not for me. Why would it be? Why would that be, Roxanne?
Because it meant to answer questions about how the natural world happened and how it functions.
Well, yes, I think that quite often science is taken that way, and I think that's an illegitimate use of science. Science doesn't tell us why we're here. Science doesn't tell us why we have this particular universe and not another universe. It doesn't tell us why. It doesn't tell us any of those kinds of things. What it does is it describes this world.
But and that's what science wants us to believe they're going to answer. That's how they get funding. Why are we trying to investigate planets around far solar systems like the most recent launch?
Because it helps business grow in Alberta.
Because it will tell us about our origins.
Our origins, I know.
We're trying to answer the question.
I know, but then, especially in that with that example, Jonathan, I kind of leave that, so it's kind of a cop-out, but I leave that to the scientists to explain. I mean, my personal view here, suspicion here, is that, although we've actually wanted to do this for a long time, but, you know, we've, in a sense, what's happened is we've messed up this world, and so instead of, like, trying to clear up the garbage in this world, we're just looking for another planet to colonize and fill up with garbage, right, and we can just let this one go, but... Tim? Shame on you, Roxanne. Tim actually had his hand up the whole time.
This whole question of whether or not these are independent is really interesting. And what I'm most struck by is the lack of a definition of the last term that you have in your title, salvation.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't.
What do you mean by salvation? If salvation means a technical fix to the pollution, global warming, etc., that's one field,
mm-hmm,
isn't it?
Mm-hmm,
if
mm-hmm.
salvation means a spiritual type of salvation,
mm-hmm.
that's totally different.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
What do you mean?
Well,
what do they mean?
Yeah, what do they mean? I think that I can say what I mean, but I don't think actually what I think in this instance is very interesting. Often I think what I think is interesting, but not this time. Salvation, of course, just means, that's part of the reason I didn't get a definition for it, because salvation just means what saving, whatever will save us. And the reason I didn't give any more of a definition of that is because you're quite right, Tim, it depends on what we think is wrong in the first place. So first you have to answer the question, well, what's wrong? And then what's the solution? But you see, if you, for example, take a naively scientific view that we are nothing more than carbon-based life forms that are mortal and that we don't, you know, consciousness is just a property of our brains and so on and so forth, then, for example, indeed, what is wrong might be something that's not as simple as, but as straightforward as, well, you know, we've got a lot of pollution and stuff like that, so we better get a technical fix to this, smarten up. If, on the other hand, you think that we're, I don't know, you know, spiritual beings or something like that, well, then indeed, perhaps immortality is what is necessary for salvation. So how you answer that question depends on, first of all, what your metaphysics is. For these other guys, and I could go into, well, I can't go into it off the top of my head, but I've certainly read enough or done enough. For these guys, especially, not the, you know, sometimes the biologists too, but mostly the physics guy, what are they interested in? What kind of question? They're interested in immortality, of making sure that our species goes on in some form or another forever and ever and ever.
I think the thing about choosing Dawkins as an example is it's kind of like shooting fish in a barrel, as far as I'm concerned. Just because, I mean, as a scientist, we're trained to adhere to Occam's razor,
mm-hmm.
which says,
mm-hmm.
I have no need of the hypothesis that God is there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a far different thing, and arrogance in the extreme, to go on from that and say, therefore, there is no God.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So it just seems to me that Dawkins has really shot himself in the foot while he's in that barrel, by the way.
There's no mixed metaphor here at all. This is a literal fact.
And I'm not making metaphors.
It's literal. One thing, Dietmar, can you actually field the question? Like, you know,
sure.
Decide
yeah,
who goes next because
yeah.
I can't see
okay.
anything. Just in response to that, Tim, What's interesting, though, is what I find with Dawkins is that the, I know, I agree, and some of this is a straw man, right, but the theists that he pokes fun at are straw men, too. He never pokes fun at the strongest versions of theism. And then when he's confronted with, you know, this pretty sophisticated version of theism, he says, yeah, but that's not what most people believe. That's not a popular form of Christianity, therefore I don't have to deal with it. So in that sense, getting back at Dawkins is doing exactly what he does to theists, looking at the most naive view of a certain kind of scientism. The other thing is...
And neither is very helpful.
No, no. So but the other thing that I have to mention is, because you said he shot himself in the foot. I don't know. You know, in some ways, let's just put it this way. I would like to be as successful as Dawkins. He hasn't, you know, he, in a sense, he hasn't shot himself in the foot. He's enormously influential. I have refused, this is kind of mean on my part, but you know, I've refused to buy his most recent book because I don't want him to get the royalties from it.
Yeah. But I'm not so sure he's influential in his field. He's influential.
No, I don't think he actually is influential in his field.
So he's influential popularly.
Yeah.
And maybe we can catch some other people.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Great. Thank you. And then Pauline and
John. If we have the mental capacity to think scientifically and religiously at the same time, like I say in my earlier life, I was classing myself as a scientist. Now I'd be more religious or a philosopher.
Yeah.
But to me, like, the metaphysics behind religion is coming to terms with yourself and your surrounding.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas science, I would say the metaphysics is to control it so that it fits our... And to me, those two ways of looking at the world are really hard to mesh.
Yeah. And if they are, you know, if we don't have a hope for meshing them, then we're going to wind up in I don't mean this in a technical sense, but in a schizophrenic situation, right? Where this is, or where we compartmentalize. This is my other part of my life. That's another part of my life. So I'm tempted to turn the, although it's not quite fair, but I'm tempted to turn the question back to you. So how do you think they can be brought together, or you think that they can't?
Well, that's what I've been trying to do.
Yeah.
Think of ways to. Because I can see. But though my scientific mind is getting taken over by my religious mind at this point in my life.
Okay.
So, but I still know where the scientists come from. Like, these questions.
Oh, I see.
These metaphysic questions are really meaningless to in my scientific mind, right?
Yeah. Okay.
As a scientist, religion, the only value religion has is a moral code that I should follow. Right, mm-hmm. They see no value other than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although that's if that were actually the only thing, that's pretty big. Value. It's not a little thing. One thing, what strikes me as you're talking, one of the things I'm thinking, yeah, you know what? That is the virtue, or that's why it's important to have a less, for humanities students as well, but to have a less specialized and narrow education in the sciences. In other words, now, you know, of course, this is a way for me to pat us all on the back and say, well, that's what's good about Augustana, because it's a liberal arts and sciences kind of place. But in fact, yeah, because like I said, anybody can be trained to think metaphysically, so to speak, to look for metaphysics, to look for patterns, and then to start tracing the relationship between, if I can use this sort of a metaphor, but the roots of your thought to the tree of your knowledge. I don't think I should specify that in advance.
See,
what that's going to look like.
Just to answer your question, what do I think about it? I just think about it now.
Yeah.
And like, I can use science as a tool. I have no problem with that, right?
Yeah.
But I'm not at the leading edge of science. I don't have a doctor's in science. And I'm wondering if I could think of new things at that point.
In science?
Yeah. Like, if I was religious, if I could think and be innovative to think. Of ways to, you know, increase our science-based knowledge. I don't know if we could do that or not.
Yeah, I think that's a question for a scientist. Well, it's an empirical question. Can I do this? Try and see. Go ahead, Glynis.
Well, there are scientists that are very religious that still practice scientific methods and produce results.
Yeah, I think the question. I think you're right. By the way, Glynis, Barber would probably be a good example of it. But what role does religion play in how they do science and their scientific discovery? That's your question.
Well, Wendell Berry's book, Life is a Miracle,
takes on a certain version of scientific reductionism. So for him, his religious faith or worldview or whatever perspective basically challenged when science becomes too narrow. And the topsoil is for him the key example. He says, well, we know very little about topsoil. So,
yeah.
In other words, it calls, first of all, the humility within what science actually knows. And a farmer knows an awful lot about topsoil that science simply has not been able to deal with. And we can't wait for 2,000 years till every, you know, ingredient and every microbe has been analyzed. We still have to nurture and live with healthy topsoil. So that's his example, or one of the examples. But I think that's so out of his, if you want, agrarian commitments, which is part of his metaphysics, mm-hmm. he actually gets important insights into empirical facts. And one of the things is the limit of our knowledge in a lot of these areas. I mean, the Germans have the nice phrase, Fachidioten, so you're a subject idiot. So the more scientific you become, the more you know about less and less stuff. Right? And to name that. But maybe, I just a response, yeah, because then otherwise, with Holly's on.
Well, I guess just to say that I very much consider myself a scientist and also a person of faith. But part of what, for me, part of the contact there is in the classroom. Because it is in the classroom where a student says, but why are you doing that? Or what does this mean? Or where you have to talk about the limits of what it means to do science and the kinds of things science can't allow you insight in. This is not a scientific question. I say this. It's not a scientific question. It's not a question I can point to a scientific method to answer. Those answers have to come from another domain. So for me, that interaction in the classroom.
Where do you get your salvation?
Certainly not from science.
Is that what you meant? Where do you get your salvation from?
Okay, Holly, John.
Okay.
Or sorry, John, do you want to?
Well, I'm just thinking. I mean, which is good, right? So, well, thanks some more.
Okay, Holly, you're on.
Kind of so far off, to be honest, actually. But just as far as, like, this how and why question goes.
Yeah.
Even as far as, like, when we were talking before about, like, why are we exploring outer space for science and stuff like that, it's to answer these why questions of our origin. But even to look at origin, like, where does a baby come from? And you say, why is the baby here? Well, because these two people had sex, and then she got pregnant, and then there's a baby here 9 months later. But that's a why question as it pertains to the how. It's not a why question standing on its own. You know what I mean? And so I'm wondering, like, obviously this is kind of like a generalization and separating them, but do you think, like, in those four relationships that you had up there earlier, integration was one of them? Do you think that they'd be strengthened through integration? Or do you think that they're just, like...
These questions would be strengthened?
Yeah, like if science and religion were strengthened, that, like, how questions could be answered as they pertain to the why and vice versa, and therefore they'd be strengthened instead of just separating?
Yeah, I think that they would be strengthened, right? And I think that... okay, is that good enough?
Sure.
Wait.
No, wait.
Okay.
I'm waiting.
Because I think I've probably used this example in metaphysics when you were with me. So you've heard this story before is what I'm saying, so bear with me. The other people haven't heard it. You know that, like, those kinds of questions, too. Well, where did I come from? Well, you can't, you know, a little kid, right? It came from mom and dad. Well, where did mom and dad come from? Grandpa and grandma. And you go through this whole thing. Right? And so it can be this infinite regress, and then you can go back to, well, you know, we descended from, you know, so on and so forth. What did we descend from? I can't remember anymore. Like, I don't know, but, you know, hominoids and so on and so forth. And where did they all come from? Well, they came out of this soup of amino acids in a swamp. Yeah, you know, that's where life came from and so on and so forth. And finally, you get back to, you know, finally, those explanations. So if you keep on going with a how, a really bright kid finally figures out that, yes, but why? Where did we really come from? Right? And there's only two ways to stop that question with a kid or to answer a question like that. You can either, both of them are like question stopping answers. You can either say something like, because that's the way it is, right? Like the Big Bang, right? Or you can say, because God did it. And depending on how you've raised your child, saying God did it is also a way to stop questions. But what that, I think what that, that shows us, Holly, is that it's true. The how and why questions are closely related, but as long as you stick with a certain version of the how question, it's just going to be an infinite regress. It either doesn't stop somewhere, or you have to stop it with a discussion-ending question, yeah, a brute fact, so to speak. And for, you know, intelligent children and for us, intelligent adults, that's not very satisfactory.
So I'm wondering, like, because I think, I mean, for me, especially even in here, it's obvious that those two should be, like, they shouldn't just be like, okay, pick one side or the other, you know? And I think it's obvious, but I'm just wondering, like, why don't you think that they, why do you think they're so, like, at each other? Like, why haven't they been integrated more and, like, do you think that's, like, a social thing or?
Well, it's not that I don't have my own belief about why that is, but then I'm really stepping outside of any kind of expertise because it's not a philosophical question.
It's not a scientific one.
No. I think it's a sociological or psychological question.
Wait a minute.
Not your kind of psychology.
Hold on, Tim will do our next lecture.
I think two things. So I will go out on a limb and say what I think, even though is that beyond my area of expertise. I think one is that, number one, that, this comes up in a lot of my classes, so you've heard me say this before, because we actually like very simple dichotomies. Very easy if the world's in black and white. And then you just have left to choose one and choose the other. That makes it really simple. Mary Midgley, by the way, as well, has this beautiful, really lovely phrase. She calls dichotomistic thinking, she says, it's a couch for the lazy-minded. Right? So you can just go and, you know, choose dichotomy and go and lay on the couch for the for the rest of your intellectual life. Yeah, okay, that's all I'll say. I know I said I was going to come up with another reason, but we'll just leave it at that.
Can I follow that up just for a second?
I'll time you.
Okay. thinking about this idea of a dichotomy of thinking and the whole idea that we are interested in this development of the independent, it seems to me that it all revolves around certainty and the fact that people like certainty.
Yep.
And
yep.
The track record of science is certainty.
Yep.
And that has privileged science in ways that we can't even begin to to measure at this point. To the point where, you know, any kind of alternate intellectual approach has to couch itself in terms of being pseudoscience in order to get any kind of...
to get funding, like you said.
Well, not necessarily funding, but just any kind of acceptance in the mind of the public.
Yep.
And the public has been trained, and so the question becomes, how do we get a more receptive public to the other side of this whole issue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree with you, so I'll put it positively. I really agree with you. And I think that some people have done some interesting histories about how some of these views of science, like in the 17th century, that it's not an accident that they grew up, that they came to the forefront in an area where socially there were all the religious wars going on in Europe, particularly in England, and so on and so forth, and that science was something like a refuge or a haven. As well, it's since Descartes, and you know, Descartes' social situation, not to mention his personal life, but certainly his social situation, was a time of great uncertainty. He had been a soldier, war was breaking out every other minute, kind of situation. And what he was looking for was absolute certainty, and ever since then, we consider certainty to be a characteristic of knowledge, but a certain kind of certainty too. A certainty that is, certainty means something that is indubitable, something that we cannot doubt. And I don't mean psychologically. So that's an extraordinarily high standard for knowledge that, by the way, science doesn't need. Not that standard of certainty, but that's what we're looking for and longing for. I think you're right.
Yeah, but we don't need that standard. All we need is the scientific approach that says, yes, if I elevate the gun barrel this much and I lead the plane by this much,
I'll get the plane. Yep, yeah. I think you're right.
So on my speaker's list, I have John, Roxanne, and then Gerhard.
Kenneth, I'm pleased you made the distinction between scientists and popularizers. I think it's critical. The examples you quoted with Dawkins and Hawking, if they were writing as scientists in scientific publications, they would never be able to publish that material.
Absolutely.
They would be purged by their peers.
Yeah.
They have to write science in scientific publications. Publishers are happy with that because they know they've got a captive academic market to sell their journals.
Yeah.
But you write popular science, and no matter how good you are at creating metaphors to explain the difficult subjects, probably just want to sell books. Mm-hmm. So when you create the controversy, well, for physics and biology, physicists and biologists, it's really easy. You just challenge biblical inerrancy, and you're home free with well, the sad thing is, and you alluded to this, that when they're trying to create that controversy, they lapse into stereotypes.
Yeah.
And both Dawkins and Hawkins, for years of dining at high table in Oxford and Cambridge, have not moved beyond C.P. Snow's Two Solitudes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
I do you think they've read
C.P. Snow? Probably not. It's much quoted,
seldom
read. Yes, yes. Much like Hawkins' work. And perhaps there's the key take-home message here. If you want to learn about science, don't necessarily listen to popularizers of science.
No, I know. Yes, absolutely. And this is what, and so, you know, this is also why when I want to be upfront about admitting the limit of my scientific education as well. But yes, right, that's why something like a liberal arts and science faculty is so important, because the only way you're going to really know something about science is not by reading those guys, but by... There's no easy way to get around it. It's sort of like learning a language, you know. That means you have to take the course. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I will say, however, and I don't know if this is, if you were being cynical, John, so maybe you weren't, but I mean, I actually think, though, somebody like Dawkins, I know he's an easy target, but I think he really believes the stuff he says.
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah, okay, yeah. He's not doing it just to make money. But that's why, and I know I was being sarcastic, and it's hard for me not to be sarcastic here, but I think that's why I pointed out that they have not actually practiced science for years and years and years. Like, when was the last time Dawkins was in a bloody lab?
Well, he's always been a theoretician, really.
That
was the huge success of the selfish gene. But with Dawkins, he then wandered off into metaphysics with his meme theory, which he tried to pop out the selfish gene. And then it's been generally regarded as flaky.
Like Sagan is regarded as flaky by most physicists. Yeah. Yeah, but his films are shown in high school.
Roxanne?
You kind of teased us with integration. Do you have a instance?
You mean an example of integration?
Yeah, hmm. On the hook.
On the hook? What? Hoof. On the hoof. Okay. Gap when accent versus a natural accent again. Hey. Not that deaf, Craig. I know that I can find it, but I can't give you an example from science because, the problem is, because I'm not a scientist, so even when I know that there are examples from it, I don't understand them. So there's an honest answer for you. What it looks like from from the non-scientific, or so in other words, from the humanities to the religious side of the equation, is somebody like Ian Barber, who is enormously prolific, who used to practice physics, doesn't anymore. And what he does, what he has done, and I can understand how. So in his books, I can understand half of it. I can understand the philosophy half of it. Or I have a hard time with the physics half of it. But he has, for example, a book where he talks about physical evidence, so evidence from physics is what I mean, for the philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead, right, which is process philosophy, and which I'm familiar with. I'm familiar with it as philosophy, and I suppose anybody who does theology would be familiar with it as process theology, but I've never looked at that, so I don't know what it is. But anyways, what I find kind of interesting about it is, in that instance, is he uses evidence from physics evidence as from physics to say, this is actually a pretty good ontology, Whitehead's ontology. But part of what I'm admitting, Roxanne, is I'm an example, I suppose, of part of the problem, which is I don't have enough scientific background. Was it Gerhard, though?
Yeah, Gerhard, and then Craig.
Well, Glynis also.
Pardon?
Glynis also.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. I'm uncomfortable in your definition of science.
Yeah.
Your control is mentioned.
Yeah.
The way I like to
distinguish
between technology.
Yeah.
I don't think enough is done.
Yeah.
Can you project a tiny bit?
Sorry, just so that people in the room don't leave thinking science equals control, there are dissenting voices. And, you know, I like the thinking of some of the more famous scientists than some of the ones you've mentioned. I'll actually bring in a mathematician. His name's Henri Poincaré.
He
has a quotation that goes something like, a scientist doesn't study nature because it's useful.
No.
A scientist studies nature because it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't, it wouldn't be worth studying, and if it wasn't beautiful, life wouldn't be worth living. He goes a long way.
Yeah. Yes.
So, that's, I'm not sure. I could be wrong, but I think that's where most scientists come from.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree with you, Gerhard. I mean, I agree with you. Why do I always put it in a negative sort of way? I really agree with you. I want to reiterate that what I said, control there, it's nothing sinister or nefarious.
But it is
control in the sense that if you're doing what science does, right, you're looking for cause and effect. Part of the way you do that is by predicting. Part of the way you find out cause and effect is by predicting. So you come up with a hypothesis, then you design an experiment to measure that or to test that. And if you get what you predicted, the result you predicted, you found something. You found cause and effect. Which means that you can, to a certain extent, control it. So I guess what I'm saying is I agree with Poincaré that it's not that the point of science is not, that they don't study nature because they want to use it or because it can be useful. However, the way in which science goes about studying nature almost always means that it could be used for applicable. The other thing that's kind of interesting, though, is the example that you gave. And you're right, I didn't give any examples of mathematicians. But, see, mathematicians are, I want to find a neutral word, interesting. and the reason math is interesting is because, and I'm sure you've heard this debate too, people argue, and I tend to agree with this argument. I don't think math is a science necessarily. It's not a natural science, right? It's not natural. So then mathematicians too are also an anomaly. They're not like other scientists. Paul Cavi, do you know anything about his background? Was he Catholic?
He was on the line. I don't know. Probably.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting how something. See, there's a good example. It's not. It's probably not as technical. It's not as concrete as people would like as an example. But there's an example of how there's an integration there between myth making and the science. It's beautiful.
But you also had Bronowski in his civilization work.
Yeah.
Pointing out that there was equal beauty in E equals MC squared as a line from Keats' Ode to a Grecian Earth.
Mine's not nearly as deep as some questions, but this whole concept of intelligent design, is that a way that, as sort of the popular mechanics of trying to set up an integrative idea that may not necessarily be an integrative idea. You're seeing it more and more in the school systems in the States, where they have this idea that you have to incorporate intelligent design into your science curriculum.
Mm-hmm. I'm
just throwing it out there as something that's happening in the average.
Yeah, So I will apologize in advance for offending people. That's not science. Mm-hmm. And intelligent design doesn't have a place there. I think it's very bad religion as well. I just think it's bad all around. Bad, bad, bad.
But how do you feel about it?
because we have this thing about intelligent design and having to incorporate it into your curriculum and so on and so forth, what that does is we cannot actually genuinely pay attention to the possibility of teleological thinking. That maybe there is order, an intelligent order to the universe. But when intelligent mind has taken control, is the default position, it makes everything look just as ridiculous, or just as naive, perhaps. Right? So once again, it's messed up as this ridiculous dichotomy. There's either intelligent design, or it's a chaotic, meaningless universe. Both of which, by the way, are myths. The universe as a casino, that was Renaud, right? Jacques Renaud? That's just as mythic as, that's not a scientific statement.
Was it a way to bring politics into it again, just as you argue that the scientists were bringing politics into their science?
Yeah, I would think so. But except that I don't know if we bring politics into things, Glennis. I think they're always already there. It's hard to get away from that.
But then back to Gerhardt's question, if politics is always in, then science, in fact, how it gets funded or how powerful sectors of society want to use science is, in fact, for control or for mastery, right? So the individual scientist may be tracking beauty.
Yeah, that's right.
But the politics of it, because we are never in a neutral space, mm-hmm. whether we're at the university or wherever we're doing our science, we're never neutral. Mm-hmm. So it is, in fact, moving it towards somebody who is interested in using your scientific discovery, and therefore you have to say, and in the future, they will find a cure for diabetes or whatever, mm-hmm. right? Whatever the project was that somebody was doing.
And no one would deny that religion is, of course, used in the same way for control.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
exactly.
The politics in
here. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Totally. Actually, I want to get back then to what Gerhardt said, because when I think about it that way, I agree with you. I think I'd be more sympathetic now, I think, because, you could be a scientist who, the control is part of it, but that it is really just get interested in nature as a thing of beauty. And how then do you guard against people taking what you've done or what you are doing and using it for some purposes you wouldn't want it to use? One thing that I would say, I'll say two things. One is that saying that you're just being neutral and there's no myth behind it is not a way to safeguard it. I think it's best to just be upfront about your values. The other thing that I'll say, and I haven't figured this out yet, but when I've taught a lot of other places, I won't mention names. So other places where I've taught a lot of science majors, because I would teach philosophy of science, and I teach women in science, and I taught science and society and religion. So I taught all these, so I used to do a lot of science majors. I find science majors at Augustana quite different. They're not nearly so naive about what science is and what it can do. So maybe you're doing a good job there, Harvey.
We have about 8 minutes, and we have Craig and Holly. At least I have. There might be others, but...
I think part of the integration needs to bring in, and as Dittmar already brought in, the politics and the economics. Part of the reason science has been so successful since the Industrial Revolution in particular is that as it morphs into technology, it has been very powerful and it's made a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so to keep the economics and politics question out of the integration, I think it's popular. That may be part of the integration.
To keep it out?
No, to bring it in.
Oh, to make it make it
because
visible.
Because I think, I think one of the big questions with science is just because we can know and predict, does that necessarily mean we should control?
Yeah.
And I think that's,
I
think that's where the conversation...
Yeah. We don't actually, we have no public forums for those kinds of conversations anymore, do we? Yeah.
This is it. The universe.
Oh, gosh, I hadn't thought of that. Because then we're in trouble, hey?
Yes.
Because we don't actually have much power. Oh, but we're academics.
Can I just say something to you?
Yeah.
When you said, politics and, because I look at politics and economics, they're both involved in that field, so... You can look at them as being an integrator, but how about a mediator as well between the two? Using the politics and economics some way as a mediation between the two. Because they're both, they seem to be both involved.
Yeah.
I know. Call me either, but I'm just saying, I don't don't know. It's just a question out there.
Yeah, yeah.
And how would you use it as an individual? I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, even when you give the last round, the last announcement to where all the new research funding is going to business in the last budget.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where the mediation is.
Right, it's not neutral, right? And traditionally, for a mediator, we want something neutral. When I say neutral, we want to make sure that they're not predisposed to one side or the other already.
Yeah, oh, I just, my comment was, like, earlier I was talking about integration, but then, like, now I'm kind of wiser in the past 20 minutes, and I'm just wondering about, like the connections that we should make to integrate them, but also the separations that we should make, talking about, like, intelligent design, or, like, what they would consider creation science, and how they're teaching creation as a science.
Yeah.
When, how you're saying it has no place there.
Because it's not necessarily
that it's, exactly, it's not science, it's not that it's useless, but it should be separated into a class of its own, like something that this is what we're teaching, and like you said, to be straightforward about their values.
Okay.
Instead of teaching creation in a science classroom, it should be taught in a religion classroom or something.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I guess you're right. The reason I mean to be far more encouraging than what I just said, I guess you're right. The reason I sound like that is because I don't think it's science, and I also think it's really poor religion. So I don't want to see it taught anywhere.
I agree, but you, I mean,
yeah.
We don't get to decide that.
No. No, that's right.
But I mean, like, so it's like being more straightforward about your values, create separations that need to be there that aren't, and integrations that need to be there that aren't, like, in both of those ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good call.
Kim had his hand up, but this, yeah, I think I'll take Phil first because.
No, Phil shouldn't get to talk.
No?
Because he's going to disagree with me. No, I know you're
this
not.
This is a safe environment.
Safe classroom. Yeah, okay.
If science and religion are both myth-making, then they're grounded in faith or belief.
Yeah.
So is there a difference between religious and scientific belief? Do you think?
No, I don't think so. That's a short answer. I mean,
thank you very much.
No, that's fair enough, actually. We can leave it there. I mean, especially, and I think I blame analytic philosophy for this, so a certain kind of philosophy, we have a very impoverished notion of belief that it's assent to a proposition. If that's the case, then scientific belief is quite different from religious belief. But if belief has to do fundamentally with making a leap of faith, right, making a choice about who I'm going to be, what kind of person I'm going to be, what my commitments are going to be, then faith is faith. Same form, different content. I mean, that's what I think. But. I know.
Mr. Duff, you have your hand up.
If I was going to ask Bill's comment there, would you put the scientific myth is more important than any religious myth, based on what you said about liking indoor plumbing and liking all the...
For me?
Yeah. Or anyone, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, are you really asking me questions about what I think?
No, as have you seen as actually a more stronger, a better thing to believe in, a better myth based on its functionality?
But it depends, Rob. I can't ask that question unless you know what is, like, unless you know what my metaphysic is or what your metaphysic is or whatever. I would give up indoor plumbing or having a meaningful life if I had to choose between those two. So the science thing is not as important to me. But the technology is very good. Thank you.